I'm Will, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Will.
It is my pleasure to introduce you to a man that that I greatly respect. You know, that he basically approached me and did what the book says. He basically took me through the steps, sponsored me, still does today. And he lives the program of Alcoholics Anonymous day in and day out. So without further ado, Chet.
Hello, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Chet Bramble. This is usually the hardest part, just getting started. Usually takes me a couple minutes before I like settle in, you know, and everything just kind of, you know, I go into like a blackout and just everything just whatever. I wake up, somebody rings the bell, I wake up and it's all over. I hope I'm not, you know, too formal here. Some people get like offended when you put on a tie to go to a meeting, but I really look at this as like, I know. But I look at this as like it's kind of like when I go to somebody's wedding or when I go to somebody's funeral, you know, I would put on a tie as a symbol of respect, you know, and I don't go to every meeting that I go to with a tie on, but when a group asks me to come up here and share my experience for them, I take it seriously, you know, and so I put this on as a symbol of respect, and, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, so, my sobriety date is January 1st, 2008. I've been asked before, you know, or people make little comments when they ask me my sobriety date, they'd be like, oh, that's one hell of a, you know, New Year's resolution or something like that. And, like, I had no idea I was going to, like, not be drinking, you know, January 1st. I didn't know I was going to stop drinking. I kind of had a sense that the end was coming. I didn't know the end was going to be the end of my drinking or the end of my life. I had no idea, but something was going to happen, something was going to give, and it did. So I look at that as a total act of providence, because it wasn't my plan. So it was somebody else's plan. I was born in Mandarin, just south of Jacksonville. It's a little suburb down there. And, you know, my parents were great. You know, just a very typical middle-class family. There's no alcoholics in my immediate family. Like, I'm kind of the anomaly, I guess, of the group, and both my parents can drink normally. They can drink as little or as much as they want. I say as much. They, you know, three or four drinks, and they're on the floor. So, which is, you know, humorous to me, but it's a tickle, you know. So my brother, I don't think that he got drunk for the first time until he was 20 years old. To this day, he's never even smoked pot or had any sort of drug that wasn't prescribed to him in his body. And anytime he's been prescribed a drug, it was, you know, he took it as prescribed. My sister, you know, she partied, and she still every once in a while, you know, she'll drink wine or she'll go to a football game or do something and drink like a normal drinker that, you know, gets a buzz. But she can, you know, she can moderate. And she can stop or leave it alone, take it or leave it, you know. She's not even really a hard drinker. So, and then there's me. I don't know, I'll describe me as a, you know, real alcoholic as time goes on. But so I had my first drink. I just turned 13 years old. And, you know, I had no idea what alcohol was going to do to me or for me. Like, I had no clue. There was this girl that lived across the street from me, and she was a couple years older than me, and I just kind of started to notice, you know, girls, and started to like them, and she was kind of a, you know, blossoming young lady, and so I just followed her around all over the neighborhood, and I mean, we were good friends, in all actuality, and apparently some other guys noticed that she was a blossoming young lady, and they wanted to hang out with her one night. These guys, one was 18, one was 19, and I guess they didn't realize it was like a package deal to hang out with her. You had to hang out with me. And but they got a 12-pack of beer. We went out to the golf course. We lived out in Valrico. And went out to the golf course. And they treated me like an equal. They split the beer up equally. I had three beers. And when I was 13 years old, I probably looked like a 10-year-old. I was just tiny. And I probably weighed like 75 pounds. And I chugged my three beers as fast as possible. I stopped for oxygen, and I stopped whenever my throat was tingling too much. And other than that, I just chugged him down as fast as possible. And I remember I finished him up, and I looked at this other guy, and I asked if I could have a sip of his beer, and he handed it to me. I just started chugging it too, and he had a snatch out of my hands, and I didn't even know what I was doing. Like, I didn't know that. I had no idea how anybody was supposed to drink or not supposed to drink. Like, this is just like, I just grabbed this beer and just started drinking it. And nobody else was doing it. Like, I was the only one doing it. I don't know what I was thinking. I just couldn't stop. And you know, things got a little weird from there. I mean, I tell this story because it's humorous, really, but it's not all that important. But I all of a sudden I'm looking over at this girl, my friend, and I'd never been in love. I had no idea what love was or is, and all of a sudden, like, I just fell for her. And I told her, you know, I was like, you know, I love you. And I think I tried to kiss her, and she was like, ew, what are you doing, you know? And I started crying. It was funny, actually. I was like, I mean, there was like snot coming out of my nose, and I was drooling, and I was like, ah! It's the story of my life. It's how I was when I got sober, you know? But one way or another, I ended up going home. And I was like an hour late, hour past curfew. Curfew was, you know, 10 or 11, whatever. I was an hour late or half hour late. And my parents were standing out front waiting for us. And they were talking to her parents, because we live right across the street from each other, and they were waiting for us. And, you know, I had this whole story set up that I was going to tell them. They took me inside. And I've been rolling around in the grass, crying, rolling around in the grass on the golf course, and the sprinklers had been on, so all the grass was wet, so I was just soaked head to toe. So they sat me down in the family room or whatever, and they started interrogating me and asking me where I was, why I was late, who I was with, and what I was doing. And I just started, like, I mean, I was just cool breeze. I was just firing off answers left and right. I remember my dog with this little American Eskimo, and he jumped up on this coffee table next to me, and I was like trying to pet him, and there I saw three of them, and like, I was trying to pet, I missed every single one of them. I couldn't find them, you know. But one way or another, like, my parents, I guess they couldn't find any, you know, they couldn't, you know, there was nothing incriminating necessarily, so they said, okay, you can go. My mom left the room, and my dad stands up, and I go to stand up, and I like take a tumble, and I catch my footing, and I'm just like, you know, standing there, my dad's looking at me, and I'm watching it. He's just like stunned, and he's like, "Boy, you've been smoking some dope." I was like, "No, sir. You've been popping some pills, no." Then he said, "You've been drinking." I kind of paused, and then I just told him the truth. I said, "Yeah," and his face like turned all these different colors. It was like, you know, pink and red and purple and blue, and his vein was like bulging on his forehead, and I thought he was gonna hit me. Like, I really thought he was just gonna deck me, but he just like just stormed out of the room, and I just stood there, and my mom came in the room, and she had this little smirk on her face, and she thought it was kind of funny, apparently, and she told me I should probably just go to bed. So I go, stumbling through the house to my room. I walk past my brother, and he's just like, you know, just shaking his head, like, what is going on here? You know, here's the guy he's 19 years old. I don't think he had a drink yet. And he's watching his 13-year-old little brother stumble by him, just stinking drunk. I go to my bed, and I don't really remember falling asleep, but I remember having this dream, and some of you guys probably relate to this, but I was having this dream, there was like all this pressure from head to toe on my body is pushing down on me, and I found this release valve. I hit the release valve, and it started feeling relief, and then I wake up, and I'm flooding my bed with urine. I mean, it's just like, it's going, usually I get more laughs out of that, but you know, and I just, I mean, it's so much, there's no point in stopping. I just let it roll. And I go tell my mom, I'm like, you know, I got this going on, and I'm hungover, and, you know, I didn't know how to clean up a wet bed. It's, you know, I'd been a long time, so I wet the bed, I still don't have any kids. So I don't know. I was like, what do I do here? You know? So that was all just my first time getting drunk, and like, it didn't get any better from there, you know. The girl situation was a very common theme in my life, but I I toiled around with alcohol when I had the opportunity for the next couple of years. It was only, it was probably less than 10 or 15 times that I got drunk. Every single drunk, I was like, I would drink until I, was out of alcohol or passed out, and I would, that was it. And then I'd go into a blackout or vomit or do something, and it was just crazy. And then, 15 years old, I tried a handful of other things, experimented with a handful of other things, and from 16 to 19 years old, I quit drinking. I didn't drink. What I did though was, I know I could just say it, but I try not to. I was like, I got really into like the Grateful Dead, and my hair got really long and funky, and I was wearing like hemp necklaces, and I ended up with dreadlocks and a big blown glass bead in my hair, I loved watching walls melt and doors breathe, and I got this smoker's cough, and I didn't start smoking cigarettes until after I turned 19 years old, but I had a smoker's cough before I turned 19 years old, so I was smoking a bunch. But so here's what happened. Like, I started dropping out of school, and I say started dropping out, like, I dropped out of one school, and then I went to a night school program, dropped out of Bloomingdale, went to Brandon Night School, quit going there, and then I got into some special program, some dropout prevention program, the Impact program at Riverview High School, and I had to do all this stuff to get into it, and I kicked butt to get into that program, and they really wanted me in that program. And then a few weeks into the regular school year, I was gonna graduate on time with my class, and I was gonna catch up my junior year during my senior year and do all my work on the computer. And I just couldn't take it, like, I had this thing going on inside of me where I just couldn't, like, I did not fit in where I was at, and I was judging my way out of high school. And I recognize now, and I realize now, what I had going on is I had untreated alcoholism. All the stuff that I was doing, smoking and dropping on my tongue, that wasn't treating my alcoholism, Like, I was dying for a drink, and I didn't even realize it. I was restless, I was irritable, and I was discontent. And when I was 19 years old, I got a job after I dropped out of high school, and I made it 6 months there, and the same thing happened there that happened in school, and I just couldn't stand what I was feeling. I just couldn't take it, and like, I had to run. I had to get out, So here's what was going on. Like, I remember going over to this, I was at this, I was at a friend's house, and there's a whole bunch of people there, and this pretty much epitomizes my spiritual malady and my restlessness, my irritability, my discontent. I'm in this house, and I've got this like sensation that hits me in the core of my being and goes all the way down to my toes and up the back of my scalp, over my head, tingling all over me, and I've got this like devastating, debilitating fear that everybody in the room around me and the world at large knows exactly what kind of a piece of shit I am, and I was absolutely terrified of everyone. And that was me without alcohol. When I was 19 years old, I was sitting around with a guy that I saw a year ago at the 164 group Tuesday night, and he'd been sober for a year and a half. I suppose he's still sober. He was one of my best friends, and he's one of my three best friends. He's the only one that got sober. Another one of them, I don't know what he's doing, but two of his kids died, and he's got charged with a crime there, and another one murdered his father. Those are my three best friends, So this one guy, we're sitting around at his house. I'm unloading my life's problems on this poor guy, just trying to figure out what I'm supposed to do next, with my life, and organize some kind of plan. And then I'm just like, we should, like, remember that stuff that we used to drink every once in a while when we were, like, teenagers? Like, I was still a teenager, but we should get some of that. So we went and we got some, like, a 12-pack of, Miller Lite or something like that, and started drinking. And like, I was walking around with that sensation all the time. That sensation of just that frightening sensation was always with me. There were times where it would peak, and I couldn't stand myself. I was ready to jump out of my skin. But one way or another, I was totally empty and totally terrified. And we got that beer, and I started drinking it, and everything got okay. All of a sudden, everything was okay. Not long after that, I went and got my GED. Not long after that, I went and got a job, and I was able to operate in the world for a little while. Like, I found something of a solution. The unfortunate thing is, when I start drinking, I don't know how much I'm going to drink or when I'm going to stop. And that's not just for one night. That can take me for a ride. I mean, that can take me for a long ride. My last drunk was 2 years and 2 days long. That was after a period of sobriety. So I went through, I just had that the next couple years from 19 to 21 years old was just a horror story. There was just a whole slew of stuff going on and, you know, going through my body, and I was just like, I was out of control, you know. And I ended up living with this girl. I ended up engaged to some poor woman, and we ended up living in her parents' house, and it's not a place that I'd be like proud of my family coming to, you know. And I'd become unemployable. Like, how the way alcohol had worked for me was not working anymore. Like, I was getting that sensation that alcohol had taken away from me. Like, I was getting that sensation whether I was sober or whether I was drunk. It wasn't working for me anymore. And so I'm living in this house, and I'm like, I've been prescribed some sedatives, benzos, and so now I'm like, I'm doing that to try and operate in life, I'm getting fired, people are firing me, and I can't work for them anymore, and I'm just falling apart. And I start having these thoughts start rolling through my head that I'd never had before, you know. I'm like, I mean, as bad as things had gotten, you know, getting arrested and whatever the heck, just loneliness and despair, mostly just loneliness. Like, I'd never thought about taking my life. And then all of a sudden, these thoughts started just coming through my head. You know, I don't know where they're just intrusive thoughts. And, I started thinking about, you know, I can, like, get a noose and, like, hang myself. I could get a gun. And I'm not, like, a gun-type person. But I thought about doing that. And then I thought about getting, like, heroin, trying to take a hot dose or something like that. And I've never shot up anything, but I was going to do it. And then one day, I was just sitting here, and I had a bottle of Xanax and a bottle of Seroquel, and I just said, you know what, I take some of this stuff and I fall asleep, and maybe if I take enough of this stuff, I'll fall asleep and I won't wake up. And that was my thoughts. Nothing dramatic, no letter, no announcement, nothing like that. Just like, I just wanted to fall asleep and not wake up. Like, I wanted to go into oblivion and not have to come back to, you know. So I took a handful of both of those, and what happens is I wake up, obviously, and I'm like half off the bed, and like my arms like hanging off of it, and I wake up and I look up, my sister, and none of my family had been to this house that I was not proud of, and my sister is standing in the doorway, and the fiance lady was standing next to her. My sister has her hands go up into her face, and she starts crying, and she thinks she's found her little brother dead, you know. And the fiance is she looks pissed off as usual, and you know, and one way or another, I end up going to a place right around the corner from here, HCC. A few days later, it was Monday, April 26, 2004, and I remember that because I was on the ride out there. And I was like, no, can we just go tomorrow? Because, like, there's a Prince concert tonight. We should go see Prince. You know, that guy's funky. So so that's how I remember that date. And the next day I went to my first meeting. I don't remember my first meeting, but I think, because I remember the schedule that we were on, I'm pretty sure it was at this place on Skipper Road, a clubhouse that was on Skipper Road, which I think has moved again. Yes, Serenity, and it was a noon big book meeting with this guy Wayne, and God, that was a long time ago. That was 8 years ago. So that's what I was in a blackout for the first couple weeks. They put me on a lot of medication that, like, I had been taking intermittently in very high doses before getting to rehab, but I wasn't taking it every single day all the time. And they put me on, and I got addicted to it there. But whatever, they did their best. They did the best anyhow. So they got me off of that. They detoxed me from the medicine they got me addicted to, and God bless them. They really did their best. I really liked the guy that was running that place. They introduced me to two fellowships, and which really confused the heck out of me, because I'm a really delusional person. I can't differentiate the true from the false. So I'm getting all this information there at no fault to them. I've got all this information coming to me from all these different angles, and I can't sort through it and figure out what the heck I am, you know. And one way or another, I ended up getting, like, some time sober, like 3 months sober, and then I left there after 5.5 months of being there, and I landed out in St. Petersburg, which is where I live now, which I left and then came back, but whatever. I landed out there, and I was like crashing. I was crashing at just wherever I could, which was it was a motel efficiency on 4th Street North and like 84th or something, just south of Gandy, a little ways. And there's in between. It was the Grant Motel, and it was in between Yaya's Chicken and a Wendy's, I think. And there's all these motel efficiencies up and down 4th Street North, and it's the only one that's been torn down. The only one, that's the one that I was at, and that was a nice place. So, I got out of there and pitted around, and I ended up getting drunk, and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up a white chip, and I was sober from January 10th, 2005 to December 30th, 2005. And, I look at that time and I've really gotten to this place where I've been called hardcore and fundamentalist and thumper and all kinds of different things. I don't know that that's, derogatory or not, but I've been called all kinds of, and I try not to be so, divisive with Alcoholics Anonymous, but like I look back at the work that I was taken through at that period of time sober, and it's not the work of our book. And it was AA light, It was my fourth step was an autobiography, and it was just all this whatever. And those guys did, my sponsor did the best he could to help me with what he had, and I love that guy. So we did a fifth step and with him and his sponsor, and he had a list of character defects and that he read to me, and I don't get it. I mean, I know Dr. Bob used to do some of that with people, but I didn't get where those character defects came from, So I was not connecting myself to what the work that we did. I made some terrible amends, started working with some guy and had no business working with him. And eventually what happened was the insanity that precedes the first drink returned, and eventually I returned to drinking. And what that looked like was, for me was, and I think this is really important for me, was, I think more important than all the judgments that I may have and opinions I may have about the work that I'd done was I was not standing on a foundation of truth. I did not know what I was, what I am. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, if I was a drug addict, if I was, both. I didn't know what was going on. My head was spinning. I didn't realize what powerlessness was. I didn't realize what it means to have no choice, to have a drink or a drug of no choice, I didn't know what that meant. And so what was happening was the stuff was floating through my head where I was like, obviously I have no business going and going to a bar in downtown St. Pete and taking a bunch of rails of cocaine off the urinal. I understand that. And I probably shouldn't be taking handfuls of Xanax. Probably not a good idea, I shouldn't be doing that. But drinking? Really? Really? Come on, drinking? Come on, drinking? Alcohol? Come on. So, I don't know. It started floating through my head. I was like, I don't know if I'm a real alcoholic. I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. And I had read the book. I was pretty familiar with the book at the time. I didn't know where it came from. But I'd read more about alcoholism, and there's in there. It's called the Marty Mann Test, and from an old timer, and where she talks about going and stepping over the nearest bar room and trying some controlled drinking, and try it more than once. And that's what I did. It took me 3 months almost to think my way into that next drink. So I try not to think my way through any drinks anymore, because when I try to think my way through a drink, I end up in a drink. So what I did was I was like, all right, I'm gonna go test this out. And I was gonna step over to the nearest bar room. For me, that was Janus Landing. I picked up a ticket to see the none of you guys are gonna know what this is, but the Benevento Russo duo with this guy Mike Gordon on bass. This is a guy from Fish. You guys know what I'm talking about. Okay, cool. I go there and I get a beer, and I've been having this thing escalate inside of me. You know what I mean? Like coming to this fever pitch. And I got that beer in me, and boy, did it work. Oh, boy, did it work. And I got hammered. I got funky and started dancing. It was a good time. Best relapse ever. And then within like 2 or 3 weeks, I was drinking every single day, and I was drinking in proportions I never drank before. And you know, I the saying that I've heard is, you know, the man takes a drink, the drink takes a drink, and the drink takes the man, and that's what happened to me, you know. And you know, that drink chewed me up and spat me out 2 years and 2 days later. My drinking the few months leading up to my getting sober was just, you know, I'd spend 4 to 8 hours a day, you know, leading up to 4 o'clock, getting off work, nursing, kind of getting over my hangover, and I might get like 4 hours of time where I'm just like totally sober, and then 4 o'clock would hit, and I'd clock out of work, and I'd go just around the block or just around the parking lot to the banana boat on Gandhi, and I'd sit down, and I'd ask for a Miller Lite, and Jess Marie would give me a Miller Lite, and then Jess Marie would start giving me free shots, and it would take me like 30 or 40 minutes to drink a Miller Lite because she kept giving me free shots. I had 5 or 6 shots, and then sometimes I'd order another Miller Lite, and I'd get more shots, and then I'd drive home, and I'd drink a bottle of wine or a bottle, you know, a little bottle of Parrot Bay or something like that. I like sweets. Anyhow, so, yeah, but that's kind of, that was like a Tuesday, you know? That was like a Tuesday, and sometimes it would get worse, and the weekends would be just a bunch of debauchery, and it was pitiful, man, I'm running out of time. So a month before I got sober, I had this experience where it was Thanksgiving weekend. The girlfriend that I was living with, she went out of town, and I'm like, it's 6:30 and 6 o'clock in the morning. I can see the light coming through the shades. I've been up all night long, and I can't seem to get drunk and shut my head up. And I end up going into this just total introspective nightmare. And I'm like, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drunk, I'm a piece of mess, and blah, blah, blah. And I go to the kitchen, and I start grabbing bottles from the freezer, from the refrigerator, and I'm like, I can't drink anymore, I'm going to die, this is going to kill me. And I'm pouring alcohol down the sink drain, and as I'm telling myself, I can't drink anymore, and I'm pouring it down the drain, I pick the bottle back up, and I pull it up to my mouth, and I start drinking more. And I'm like crying, I'm like, I'm falling apart, and I just don't know what I'm doing. Like, I am at that moment in the clutches of alcohol, totally drinking against my will. Totally drinking against my will. That's powerlessness, you know. I spent the next month trying to control and enjoy my drinking and sometimes stop. And what was happened was I would go like 24 to 36 hours without a drink. And I would either forget that I was quitting drinking, change my mind, or just go through a strange mental blank spot. Ended up with a drink in my hand, and I'd be drunk and on another bender for a week or two at a time. And then January 1st comes around, and, you know, it's the middle of the day. It's like 2:30 in the afternoon, and just got back from, we went camping for New Year's Eve, and the girl that I'm living with basically tells me I need to move out and probably get another girlfriend. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to I don't know where and try and find out where I'm going to go. And what I do is I was living in Mango Sefner, and my parents were in Valrico, Bloomingdale, so I drive down Lithia Pinecrest, and I pass by this clubhouse that I'd seen before, and I didn't like think anything about it, but it was there. I think it registered somewhere in my subconscious, and I go to my parents' house, and I walk in, and as soon as I see my mom, I start crying, she starts, you know, I hug her, and she hugs me, and then comforts me, and then she says a bunch of stuff, and the only thing I heard was, you know, you need to be clean and sober, which was the last thing I wanted to hear. I needed a drink, you know? And so I storm out of the house, and I'm driving back up Lithia Pinecrest. I'm not sure where I'm going, and I get to this spot. There's a stretch of road. It's like less than a half mile long, probably, between Brooker Road and Lumsden Road Causeway on Lithia Pinecrest. And it's that stretch of road where that clubhouse is. And I'm not thinking about the clubhouse, but what I am thinking about is, like, what I'm going to do. Like, what's going on? I'm like, you know, it's like my first drink all over again. I got the snot going, and my eyes are blurry. I'm trying to stay on the road. I'm just falling apart. I'm terrified. I'm despair. Like, I'm just feeling absolutely horrible and afraid. And I can't imagine feeling any more afraid. And all of a sudden I think, like, what do I do next? What now? And then the thought that comes in my head is go have another drink. And then that thought was more terrifying than the terror I was experiencing. And I had what I've heard described as a moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity didn't come around as, I think I'm going to go do this, I think I'm going to go do that. It came down as everything slowed down for me. All my perception, all my thinking, everything slowed down and nearly stopped. And right as it happened, there's that clubhouse coming up on my right. I'm getting chills thinking about it. So I there's like five or six cars in the parking lot. I pull in. I sit down in the meeting, and halfway through the meeting, they pass the seventh tradition basket, and they ask me if we would like to share, and the chairperson is looking right at me, and everybody else is looking at me, including the schmuck sitting behind me. I can feel his eyes in the back of my head, and I'm like looking around. And I raise my hand. I don't know why I raise my hand. Everybody's looking at me, waiting for me to speak, and I raise my hand. I haven't even thought about anything. I'm just like on autopilot. I end up in this meeting on autopilot, and I raise my hand. I said, "My name's Chet. I'm powerless over alcohol," and I didn't know to say that. I didn't think about saying that. And, right then and there, I had a first and second step experience, And, I knew I was mastered. I knew I was overwhelmed. I was licked. Alcohol had me. And the other end of that, the other side of that coin, I was there, I was willing to believe that there was something out there that could help me. That's exactly what I was doing in a meeting, So I did the first two steps. I didn't have a sponsor yet. 4 days later, I went to a meeting and a man approached me, and he'd known a spiritual experience and he offered it to me. And 2 weeks sober, 2.5 weeks sober, he'd read the book to me, asked me a couple questions. We did a third step prayer. He pointed out page 60 something and how it works, 63, 5, something like that, and he said, "Do that." And he didn't really, he didn't give me very good directions. He didn't explain anything. He just said, "Let's just do that." And I took it home and I did it 4 weeks later. And I did that fourth step, and there was some turmoil that happened. And I was just getting eaten up, and I just finally did it. And really the way I look at it was that, 6 weeks sober, 5.5 weeks sober, whatever it was, when I started writing was when I'd done the prayer and whatever with him, but that's when I made that decision. That's when I did the third step. I made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the power of God, and as I understand him. So I started writing, and within a few days I had it done. We sat down within a few days from that. We sat down. There was actually some event in South Tampa at this Palmacia place, and this guy Sandy was talking, and I wanted to hear him, and we do my fifth step, and he goes in. My sponsor went in to go listen to him speak, and leaves me out there. He says, "You got to sit for an hour and do this, that, and the other, and thank God from the bottom of your heart, and review the first five proposals and stuff like that, and then you're going to do this, 6 and 7, and so that's what I did. And he came back out and he gave me directions for an eighth step, and he did something that I wouldn't necessarily do today, but this is what he did and it worked for me. He gave me directions for the eighth step, and he told me to go find somebody to sponsor, and that's what I did. And I just followed directions, and so I got the eighth step list going, and I grabbed a guy that I went to a meeting and they handed a, he said he was new, and they handed a meeting list around a where and when, and everybody wrote their names on the list. Mine was the last one on the list. He called the next day. He called everybody on that list, and mine was the last one. I'm the only person that answered or called back, and a bunch of freaking assholes. So I picked him up, and I just did what, it was great because, I didn't yet think I knew anything. 6 months sober, I knew everything. But, at that point, I didn't, So I was just like, God, 12 steps, action, big book, let's do this. And that's what we started doing. And I started making amends. I started taking this guy through the book. And I started working, obviously, on the amends. I started working on I'd done inventory. And I was working, I was dabbling with meditation, and I was praying. And all of a sudden, that girl that had broken up with me, I went to that meeting after she broke up with me, and then I went back to the house, and before I got to tell her that I went to a meeting, she was like, "I think that we should give it another shot." And I was like, "Okay," and I pulled out a white chip. I was like, "I'm an alcoholic, and I can't drink anymore, And so one way or another, 2 months sober, around 2 months sober, she changed her mind again, and she decided, "I need to go find another place to live and probably get a new girlfriend or something." One way or another, get the hell out of her house. I fell apart. I was raw, 2 months sober, and I didn't know what was going on. I went to work the day after she broke the night. She broke up with me one night, and the next day I went to work, and an hour and a half into work or 2 hours into work, I'm on the verge of tears, and I'm I didn't think that, I wasn't sure that I would have myself talked into going to the bar by 4 p.m. So I called this guy that I knew, and he said, well, and I said, I don't know if I should just go to a meeting or what. He's like, that wouldn't be the worst thing you did. So I went into my boss's office and told him something. They let me go, and I went out to this clubhouse, Brandon, and I did what everybody always says to do, and you know, they said, is anybody having trouble staying sober, thinking about drinking? I raised my hand, and I'm all like, I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired, effed up, insecure, neurotic, emotional, restless, irritable, and discontent, and I, you know, want the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a few drinks of alcohol. And, you know, and some lady was like, woo, you know, about to pass out or something, and, you know, I was like, I'm having trouble trusting God, and that was the truth. I was having trouble trusting God and what's going on, where I'm going, what's happening here, and I mentioned, you know, this little thing about, you know, this girl broke up with me and I, whatever, and the whole meeting turned into group therapy session, and you know, what I walked out of that meeting feeling worse than I did when I walked in. So I don't go and share my problem. I don't drag my problems into Alcoholics Anonymous unless I'm sharing a solution afterwards. That's just me. Not everybody agrees with that, I guess. But I was going back and forth from my parents allowed me to come stay with them for a little while. So I'm going to her house and picking up my stuff and going to my parents' house and dropping it off. And, you know, I'm going up that same road, Lithia Pinecrest, the same road that I was going up and down the day that I got sober, January 1st. And, you know, the thought hit me, this thought occurs to me, it's like, you know, I gotta do something now, because I'm experiencing the same sort of pain that I was experiencing January 1st. Like, I'm you know, crying, the whole mess, and you know, the snot and all that jazz. And I'm like, I gotta do something now. And I'd been given directions for a nightly inventory that he called a 10-step, which is not the way that I understand a 10-step today. But I was like, you know, the directions were at night, constructively review your day, and do it on pen and, with pen and paper. And I'm like in my car, it's 1:30 in the afternoon, the sun's shining, it's not dark, I'm not about to go to bed, I can't sleep, I'm freaking out, and I don't have pen and paper on me, and I'm like, I gotta do something, you know? So what I did was I just pictured my inventory, and I went across the columns, and I got to character defects, and I asked God to remove them, and I very desperately, like very earnestly, said, God, please take these, they're killing me. And then that, after that girl got off work, she called me up and asked me if I was coming by her house again. I was like, I guess I can come by and get some more stuff. She wanted to see me. And I went, and I talked to my sponsor about what was going on. He told me not to make amends to her. I went over there, I made amends to her anyways. And it was great. It was actually, I think, exactly what I was supposed to be doing. And that all through that time, and just after that time, I spent my time, you know, like I'd be calling people, just blathering about my problems and me and blah, blah, blah. And then I would get a call from that guy that I was working with. And all of a sudden, I'd totally forget about me. Just completely forget about me. And then I'd get off the phone with him. And then if I started thinking about me, all of a sudden I'd remember, I got to work with this guy. What am I going to do next? And I don't know what to do. So I'm just reading the book. I'm like, what do I do next? You know, I start reading the book, you know, and I'm thinking about, what am I going to do to help this guy? And when I'm doing that, I'm not thinking about me anymore, and I'm feeling okay, you know? And then I go and I speak at this, it's my first time talking, it was like 62 days sober, it was this juvenile Department of Corrections thing, rehab place, a bunch of 13 to 17-year-old kids that have legal problems and drug charges and stuff like that. And I mean, it was terrible, but one way or another, I walked out of there and I got hit with something that was just amazing. It was, I mean, right then and there was when I recovered from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And you know, I don't announce myself as a recovered alcoholic when I introduce myself at meetings, just because I don't want to create a divide. I don't want people to shut their ears to me. But I am a recovered alcoholic, you know, and I do what I can to stay in a state of recovered, you know. For 2 days, I was high as a kite. I mean, like, I get it today. Every once in a while, like, I get these, like, attacks from, like, attacks of love from God, I think, just all over my heart, just like, like God is, like, trying to, like wrestle me to the ground in my heart. I mean, it hit me then, and I was high on that stuff for, like, 2 days. 2 freaking days, I was just, like, lit. And the strangest thing happened to me, and it was probably the highest I've ever been in my life. And, like, I wasn't thinking. all the time. Like, I had to choose when to think. It wasn't like this constant, steady stream of blathering nonsense going through my head of commentary of, oh, that guy driving by with a funny forehead, you know, and like whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it was quiet. There was peace, you know? And, you know, I mean, I came down and I think a lot, you know, but it hasn't been as bad as it was just before that, you know? And that was my spiritual experience. And I look back at like 11 and a half months sober, I was reflecting upon that experience, and I just read the 10th step. And I realized that there was a series of actions that I took there that was the 10th step. And the way that I describe that is, you know, the 10th step is, you know, you continue to watch for these four things: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And like, I didn't know that I was watching for those things, but they were like killing me, like my head was attacking me. So I looked for those things where they were, and then you ask God at once to remove them when they crop up. And so I asked God to remove them, and I just was like, I didn't know what to do, you know, is what I was doing. And again, I think it's a total act of providence. I think it was God guiding me. And then I discussed it with somebody, and that was my sponsor, and I don't really think he understood, but I still did it anyways. And then I made amends to that girl. If anybody had been harmed, I made amends to her. And then I resolutely turned my thoughts towards someone I could help, and that was that guy that I was working with. And there's another part in the book where it talks about sharing your complete story with somebody, something like that. And I did that at that DOC treatment facility. And then right after that was when I had that spiritual experience, you know. So that's really powerful for me. I really changed the way that I viewed the 10th step. You know, there's a nightly inventory. That's the 11th step inventory. So anyhow. So from then on, I didn't have that spiritual experience and suddenly like everything straightened out spiritually for me. I didn't just suddenly straighten out spiritually. Like, I went through some rough times. I was 4 months sober, and that guy was 2 months sober that I was working with. And I basically got cornered at a meeting where we were at, and these guys told me I had no business working with others because I didn't have enough time. And they came at me with this pamphlet from GSO that says it suggests you get a sponsor with over 1 year sober. And which irks me. And one way or another, you know, I walked out of there with a resentment that I didn't realize that I had, and for a long time. And that resentment, you know, from resentment, all forms of spiritual disease grow. And that resentment festered for 2 years. And I had this thing like, I would crop some of it. I would just kind of hit some of the stuff off the top that was coming off that resentment. Like, other resentments would come off of that, and I would take care of them as I could, just enough to, like, be okay, you know, and get by. And it wasn't until I was, like, 2.5 years sober where I realized, you know, I dove back into inventory, and I found out what was going on. So I went around Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of years with a major chip on my shoulder, you know, wanting to make sure that not only you knew that you were wrong, but that you knew how right I was, you know. And that's cool if you there's nothing wrong with somebody that stays sober without sponsoring for a year. You know, I mean, that's great if you make that, you know, but like, don't, somebody that's been through the work, don't try and deter them. If I see that happening, I'll give you hell personally. But what happened was I got a text message from this guy in it was November of 2009, a little over a year and a half sober, almost 2 years sober. And the text message was, "We're going to Vermont." And I was like, "What? We're going to Vermont, call you later." And I'm like, "What is this?" You know? So like, an hour goes by, and I'm like, "I should just call this guy, you know? Like, what's going on here?" And I pick up the phone, and I'm getting a call from a number I don't recognize, but my phone says where the call, what state the call's from, is Vermont. I'm like, what the heck is this? A practical joke? And I pick up the phone, and this guy, he's like, "Hi, my name's Ian. I got your number from so-and-so." The so-and-so was, we had the same sponsor at the time. And he said, "I'm on the I'm the program director," or something like that, for this ECPA, Eastern Area Conference of Young People of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're having it in April 2010 in Burlington, Vermont, and I wanted to see if you'd come up here and talk on one of the panels. And I said, "Okay." And he said, "It's going to be practicing principles." I'm like, "Yeah, this guy doesn't know me," but I agree to it. And I go up there, And this guy is like, we were like walking around through the, we were walking, like I'd never been up to Vermont. So we're like, you know, going through the woods and just checking stuff out and like all these cliffs like with rocks and stuff like that. And he's describing to me how he works with others and how he takes people through the big book. And I'm judging him. I'm like, you know, this guy probably sits in his room just reading the big book all the time while I'm out trying to help people, you know? And boy, was I wrong. The guy was sponsoring like 30 people. And he was just helping a lot of people. He was helping a lot of people. Most of those guys are still sober, and they're helping a lot of people. And one way or another, like I, you know, it was all success. You know, go home, and then and I'd gotten so sick, like I started doing something that I didn't. Can I get 5 minutes?
Sure.
Cool. Thank you. And I. thanks. I went to. I just gotten really sick, and I kind of went against my own. You know, my own better judgment. And I was 2.5 years sober, and I was dating a girl who was 6 months sober. And not that there's any time, like not a certain amount of time that qualifies you for sponsorship or relationships. There's people 10 years sober that have no freaking business having any sort of romantic relationship with anybody. And but I, one way or another, I got into that relationship, and, you know, it started coming to an end. And I realized it was coming to an end, so I took inventory on it, and I got my part out of it, and I went to make amends so I can try and clean it all up. And I went over to her house, and I made amends to her, and she broke up with me. And then I go back to the house, and like I'm calling my sponsor, and I'm like, this happened, and blah blah blah, and I'm like, can I talk to you later? Because he's kind of busy. He's like, okay. And I call him later. He's like, and I'm like, you know, whatever. And he's like, I don't know why we need to talk anymore. What are we going to talk about? He started laying into me. And I'm like, I'm confused. I'm lost. I don't know what to do. He's like, go freaking help somebody. You're like, what else is there to do? Go help somebody, you know? So I go and I get out of the shower. I'm like crying in the shower, which is the perfect place to cry because my dad was home. I was still living with my dad. And so I was like trying to be quiet. Like, and I get out of the shower and I hit my knees and I ask God to remove everything that stands. I never have said this prayer before. I just said it then. I ask God to remove everything that stands in the way and hinders my ability to experience Him and help others and put somebody in my life that can that I can be of service to. And I go to this clubhouse that night. I called up a friend. He said he'd meet up. And I go to this clubhouse, 3333. And I'd been to that clubhouse, you know, a few times, but I hadn't been on that night for that meeting since I was, like, in my first couple months sober. And I go to that meeting, and I end up at that clubhouse three different times that night. I sat with two different guys for an hour. I had four different people ask me for help. I never had anything like that happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of a sudden, I'm just, like, flooded with people asking me for help. A few days later, I'm riding around in my car, and I'm listening to all these big book workshops that I got from that guy that asked me to come up to Vermont. And it's, these guys, Peter M. and Dave F. and Mark H. and Joe H. and, you know, just the usual suspects, really. And I'm listening to these guys talk about the first step, and I'm like, I'm in my car one day, and all of a sudden, like, I got hit with this feeling that, like, or I guess it was just, like, I just got hit with a realization that it was no longer a matter of, like, if I was going to drink again, it was a matter of when. And all of a sudden, I just had this first step experience. I got reconnected to my first step, and I got scared. I got real scared. And one of those workshops that I've been listening to is this guy, Joe Hawk. He's passed away. I don't think he minds if I use his name. And it was a series of talks called The Work. And he describes how he takes people through the work, through the big book. And he had described exactly what that guy, Ian, had described to me when we were tromping around through the woods in Burlington, Vermont. And I was like, I guess I should just call this guy up, you know? And I called him up, and I asked him, like, in three different ways if he's doing the same work that this guy described in these talks. And he was like, absolutely. And that guy, 1,500 miles away, started taking me through the big book over the telephone. You know, and think what you want, but you know, my God doesn't see any state lines or boundaries or anything like that. And it worked, man. We did a fist step on Skype, you know. And but what happened was I finally started to straighten out spiritually, you know. And rather than just having, like, you know, really high experiences and glimpses of it, like, in some comfort, like, I started to settle in my own skin, finally, you know. And it took some work, you know. He sat down, on the telephone. He described the circle and the triangle to me, explained it to me. He talked to me a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous as we went through the preface and the forewords, and then we went through the doctor's opinion, and we went through, you know, and I had work to do on each chapter before we read it together, and stuff that I, you know, highlight things I identify with, highlight statements of hope and promise, go through pages one through nine and or 1 through 8 in Bill's story, and I highlight where I think, drink, or feel like Bill, just stuff like that. And then we get to the fourth step, do the fifth step on Skype, and like I start to like telling people what I'm doing, and like these people just start asking me to like work with them. And there was like one guy there's one guy who's in this room that I was still kind of in this I mean, I was on fire because like. I mean, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to drink again. I better do something. So I started driving out looking for new guys. I started driving from Valrico out to Turning Point, Sheldon Road, to go find new guys. And I go to this meeting, and it's Wednesday night. There's like 80 people there, and there's one person that says that he's new. And after the meeting, I did what I normally do, is I watched to see if anybody went to go talk to him. And nobody goes to talk to him. So I'm like... like, you know, like juking people, like pushing my way through, and I go grab them, and I just make the approach like somebody did with me. And, you know, one way or another, you know, I went through that work, and I got hit with a huge influx of people to work with, and it, you know, it's been, I mean, what a blessing, you know what I mean, like what a blessing that's been. And, you know, these guys have saved my butt, really, and I don't even think they're aware of it. I mean, hopefully they are, because I read the book with them, but, you know, it's just been, like I started, you know, I got that GED, like I told you. I'd never taken any college courses, and a year and a half ago, I finally went to school for the first time, which was really hard for me to do. And I signed up, like everything. I waited the last minute, and I signed up, and I got into the first class I get into. I had to start at pre-algebra. I sat down in the class, and I'm like, well, it's going to be tough, but I mean, it's still just pre-algebra. I sat down in that class, and the first night I'm in there, and I'm like about to have a panic attack. You know, the teacher's flying through this stuff, and I'm just about to start crying. I'm like, I'm ready to walk out, and I get out of there, and I start calling out other alcoholics. And over the class is over, and like, you know, they start offering me help and hope, and you know, so one of the things that's happened is taking on, you know, more life, you know, that's been provided to me, taking on more life. Not every night I can make it to a meeting, you know, and just. I work, I go to school, things happen. And what happens though is, you know, when I need somebody to talk to, and it's one of those nights that I didn't make it to a meeting and I gotta go to bed so I can go do the same damn thing over again, one of those guys I'm working with calls me up with a problem, you know? And, you know, God provides. So, you know, this has been, I love the 164 group. I've only been to it twice. Each time was to give Will a medallion. I was here last Tuesday. The first time I came, you know, a year ago in July, as soon as I mentioned the guy that approached me to sponsor me, like I started choking up, but I held back the tears. And then this past Tuesday, you know, it went beyond that. I was choking back the tears, talking about the guy that approached me, and I was choking back talking about, you know, seeing it go full circle, you know? And so the other thing about 164 group is like, I go to a lot, you know, I've been to tons of meetings. I've been to meetings all over the place, and all the way out to Seattle, all the way up to New England and Mid-Atlantic and all that jazz, all over Florida. And like, go to a lot of meetings where a lot of people are reading the big book, but a lot of them don't seem to really like get what they're reading. And you know, I love it when I go to a meeting where there's people in there that know what it's like to drink against their will, and what powerlessness really means, and not having a choice and a decision in the matter. And you know, that big book has given me some choices and some decisions, and every single one of those choices or decisions comes down to, do I choose God? You know, what kind of God do I choose? You know, it's all up to me. And I don't know. So, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has been a wonderful thing for me. I mean, I don't know if I would be dead or in jail or where I would be. I don't really need to speculate. I just know that my life was terrible, you know, and I was falling apart. And and I didn't know what the hell to do with myself. I ended up here, and it's just gotten just so much better. You know, there's love in my life. There's people in my life. Like, I have hope. You know, my parents want me around. I got to babysit my nephews and nieces a while back. We watched Soul Surfer. And my God, I was 20 minutes. I was on the verge of crying for 20 minutes, just sitting there like, I didn't want to watch it. And like my niece is like bored with it. She's the one I want to watch it. And I'm just like, she's like, you want to turn it off? I'm like, no, no. And, you know, oh gosh. And it's just been happening, you know, like just something happened the past like six, nine months where I just got really soft, you know, and it's a good thing. So I appreciate you guys having me here. It's always a pleasure to come and speak and share my story. You know, I always come away from it feeling just incredible. And if anybody, you know, wants any help with anything, I don't need to be your sponsor to help you. Just come and talk to me. And thank you. Love you.
Thank you so much, Chet. That was really fantastic and extremely inspiring. Thank you.